Welcome to episode number 39 of the Minnesota Music Shakedown, a podcast dedicated to spinning some of the best original Twin Cities and beyond area music. Featured this week are conversations and new music from the legendary Tony Monaco. I'm your host, Mark Sterry. Check me out at marksterrymusic.com, and thank you for supporting live and local music.
Thank you.
song, Da Daddy, off Tony Monaco's new record, Over and Over. Up next, The Conversation. Mr. Tony Monaco, welcome to the Minnesota Music Shakedown. How's it going today there, Tony?
Man, I'm doing great. It's good to see you, Mark.
It's good to see you too, Tony. I became obsessed with the Hammond organ as of late and found Tony, considered one of the best organists, in my opinion, I've ever heard of or seen, and he is lucky. I'm lucky enough that he picked me up as kind of a student. So Tony's been teaching me a few things, and I just think the world of the guy. And Tony, where are you zooming in from today?
I live in Columbus, Ohio.
Is that where you're from too?
Yeah, I was actually born here.
Okay, very cool.
It was interesting starting a career from Columbus, Ohio, because you know you hear most stories about New York and, you know, California. But, you know, man, I did a lot of things, and I was lucky enough to be able to, you know, do it right out of Columbus, you know.
Yeah, I didn't know much about the Columbus, Ohio music scene.
It's very rich, and we had, you know, some, you know, past greats, like Don Patterson was from Columbus, who did all that work with Sonny Stitt. We also had another great named Hank Marr, and we also had another one named Bobby Pierce. Now, Bobby Pierce is still alive. He's residing in sunny California somewhere, but he was like those three. I never really got to know Don very well, but Hank and Bobby were like very instrumental in my development because they sort of took me under their wings when I was really young. And brought me into the music because that's what it takes, mentorship, you know?
I agree. When did you first discover the B3 organ and its sound? Because didn't you start playing accordion?
I did, and my journey began with a door-to-door salesman selling accordion lessons, if you can believe that, you know. I was 8 years old, and somebody came knocking on the door, and he had an accordion, came in the house and said, hey, do you want to try to play it? You know, my mom made him espresso and everything. You know, he was an Italian guy. My parents were immigrants, you know. So I started playing the accordion. But when I was 12, I was given a Jimmy Smith record. And I had a little record player up in my bedroom that I played 45s of the Beatles. And I had to change the adapter and the speed. And the first song was the 22-minute Jimmy Smith, The Sermon. And the guy that gave me the record played in a wedding band with my dad. They played a quartet. You know, they had a bass player, accordion player, sax player. My dad played some drums. So the accordion player, who was a really good musician, decided to buy a Farfisa organ. And the whole purpose was to get rid of the bass player so that those three could make more money, right? It was an economy of scale. So he handed me this record. I remember their rehearsal. Never forget it. It was in the basement of Mike, the accordion player. He had this Farfisa organ, you know. And they were rehearsing. And at the end of the rehearsal, he gave me this two-album set of Jimmy Smith's greatest hits. And his exact words to me were, Anthony, I'm not really into this music. He says, but give it a listen. You might, you know, like it. And so I remember running over to my house and going upstairs, and he told me I had to take the 45's adapter off so that the little hole of the, you know, long play would fit the album. And I changed the speed, and the whole side of that one album was The Sermon. And by the time that track was done, I knew that I was going to be an organ player. That was it. That's when I knew what I wanted to do, and I've never looked back.
What was it about the organ that resonated so much with you? Probably the same thing as everybody else. It just sounds cool.
Man, yeah, you know, you got to remember I was listening to I Want to Hold Your Hands and stuff, you know, from the Beatles and playing the accordion. So I had, you know, a limited scope being a firstborn American, you know, immigrant child. I didn't have the access to all the things that maybe people who lived here did, right? So the first thing that influenced me was the sound. It's like, holy cow, listen to that velvety, spitting, fat, you know, what else can I tell you? It's like, you know, a chocolate sundae, you know. But then it was his long black fingers on the album that I could stare at. And to me, it was mysterious, you know, because I knew that those fingers were playing that sound. And I connected the two as that's what I want to be when I grow up.
It seems to, as I'm studying the Hammond greats, it seems like the artwork on their records does portray kind of a mysterious, exotic, kind of dangerous or whatever vibe to it. I'm not sure it started, but I'm a huge fan of Jimmy McNiff, and his albums have like naked women on the covers and you know, I think Jimmy Smith's got some good album covers too. So it's something about mysterious about the organ, that
the whole thing,
the whole thing.
And you know, you can't be a wimp if you're going to play this instrument. You know, it requires you to be able to split your mind, split your hands, use your feet, and deal. You know, so all four limbs are doing something different. You know, the right foot is controlling the expression. The left foot is doubling up on bass lines. The left hand playing bass lines or chords. The right hand playing melody and leads. You know, and so to get to the point where you can actually control all those things separately and be in control of that is why, you know, there's so few organists out there. And that's why the market for it is so small, because it's hard.
It is hard. I can only work on one portion of that. I don't know how you do the whole thing. I have a question. So you told me about this album to listen to, and I've been listening to it like crazy. It's the Groove Holmes and Jimmy McNiff, the giants of the organ, where they're sitting there with their band. And you said
when
it was
I got
just
that album. That was like heroin. I'm not a drug addict, but if I were, I'd be shooting that record up my veins, you know, because it is like incredible.
You said it was so greasy that you said you'd have to get an extra plate.
Did you?
You said that.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, did you get an extra
plate? I had to get one for sure. But I was curious. I was listening today while I was hiking my dogs this morning, and I think there's a bass player in there. So what do they do if there's someone playing bass?
There was no bass player there.
That was all them.
Yeah, and you know, they always talked about that Richard Groove Holmes was one of the best organ bass players. It's the attack. In other words, when you play the organ bass, it's not just playing the note, but it's how you release it so it sounds like a real bass guitar.
It had me fooled completely.
Right? It had me fooled too. That's real organ bass. That's most of that bass was being played by Richard Groove Holmes on those two album set.
Wow.
I know. It's amazing.
So I'd like to ask you, Tony, as we're talking about the influences and the kind of the old timers, who would you say would be your Mount Rushmore of Hammond B3 players?
Well, you know, I for the longest period of time, you know, when I was first introduced, I'll give you the shortest answer I can. First of all, I love anybody who attempts to play this instrument because they're a brother or sister, if you know what I mean. And there's many, many, many great organ players that I admire. Contemporaries and deceased alike, you know. My first, obviously, influence was Jimmy Smith. And, you know, like I said, being a son of an immigrant family, the only way I could get records, you know, because we didn't have the internet then, was to go to the local music store that sold records, and it was in a mall. So most of the records that I bought growing up were Jimmy Smith records, but I did find that double album set that you're talking about. I also found a little bit of Jack McDuff, and there was a local, he must have been a regional guy, his name was Johnny Hammond Smith. He was from Detroit, so there was some regional distribution. You know, that's why at the beginning of the days when to get a record deal meant you got distribution, which means your music could be heard outside of your community. That was a big deal, you know. So those were my main influences. So when I was growing up, you know, and I always use this reference that, you know, like when you're a kid in grade school and the bell rings to go play out in the playground, kids don't walk out negotiating. They run out to play. And I think when I hear young musicians, and I was one myself at one time, you know, you get influenced by all them fast notes and stuff, like running out in the playground to play, you know. And so I have to say that my, you know, development at the beginning was learning how to try to play fast notes like Jimmy Smith. He was like the fastest, you know, gunslinger in the West, you know. But then as I got older and I was able to be influenced by people who had other knowledge of this stuff, who maybe were like a guitar player who moved from New York City or something, you know, and said, "Hey, man, have you ever heard of Larry Young? Have you ever heard of Don Patterson?" And then I finally started to find their music. So at this time in my development of music, it's 56 years, I find Don Patterson to be my favorite organ player. It's ironic that he comes from Columbus, Ohio. But he's deceased now. He played with Sonny Stitt. But the reason why I like Don Patterson is he doesn't play a whole lot of notes, even though he can. He plays the whole instrument. So he's digging into the harmony. He's playing nice bass lines. He's formulating really good, you know, and he plays bebop style. So it's like listening to, you know, a bebop player on the organ. And I don't know, as I age, I kind of seem to find that, you know, exhilarating to not just hear the blues scale all the time. You know, so I like Don Patterson now. When I listen to Jimmy, I still love Jimmy, of course, man. He was my teacher, too. He called me when I was 16 years old because I was sending cassette tapes to his, I didn't know it was his supper club. I found an address in the back of one of his self-produced albums. And I was sending cassette tapes of me trying to play his music. And coincidentally, he called me on my 16th birthday.
Are you serious?
Yeah, my dad woke me up in the middle of the night. Now, remember, we didn't have headphones internet. And only the telephones were still connected to the wall, you know. So I ran to his bedroom. It was about 3 a.m. He woke me up. He said, "You got to come to the phone." I went to the phone. And you know how you could identify, how you got to know an artist? Exactly what you said at the beginning. You stare at the album. You look at those pictures and you hear every grunt because, you know, you're using your ears to pick up everything you can about what's going on in that situation because you can't use your eyes other than look at the picture. So I heard this grunt and I knew it was Jimmy Smith. To me, it was like God had just phoned in from heaven, you know. And he gave me a very powerful lesson that first phone conversation, just over the phone, he told me two things. He said, "Number one, you play too many notes," he said. Now, here's a man that played a lot of notes telling the kid that runs out in the playground to play that I play too many notes. And then the second thing he told me is that I needed to learn how to play the right chords. And, you know, man, I still take that lesson today, and let me tell you what I think it believes. What it means now, because, you know, as you age, you start to interpret. The too many notes is to when you try to play over what the music serves, needs. You know what I mean? And you hear it a lot when you listen to youngsters playing. You think to yourself, does it need all that? You know. So the right number of notes, that's the number of notes that it takes to make that music serve its purpose, right? Could be a few, could be a lot, but too many is overplaying, right? And the second thing about learning the right chords, it wasn't about like, okay, so the real book says, you know, it's a C7. The right chord is understanding why that C7 is in there and what the harmony development around that is.
Wow.
And that's why That's why when you listen to really mature musicians, they reharmonize everything, because there's more than one way to skin the cat. And so learning the right chords is to constantly be aware of the harmonic movement and substitutions and alterations that you can add to, you know, deepen the taste of the sauce, you know.
Wow.
So I'm still looking for the right chords. People say, you play a lot of harmony these days. And I always joke and say, you know, I'm still looking for the right chords. You know?
That is great. Did you ever happen to run into Jimmy Smith again?
Oh, yeah. So when I was early 20s, I was invited to play in a supper club in L.A. And that's when I became friends with his stepson, Michael Ward, who's still a friend of mine today. That's Jimmy Smith's second wife's son. Her name was Lola. So Jimmy moved from Philadelphia in a little town called Norristown, which I got to meet Jimmy Smith Jr. He looks just like his father, you know. And then Jimmy moved, and when he got married to his second wife, from Philly, the East Coast, over to L.A. So if you like to listen to the progression of Jimmy Smith, if you want to listen to what happened to him when he moved, check out the record called Root Down. That's when that, you know, the Beastie Boys, they actually did a remake on that too.
Really?
So Jimmy Smith, like Miles Davis, was able to change his music through the generations to stay. You know, Miles Davis, they said he changed his music five generations, you know, to stay relevant to the time. And I think Jimmy Smith was an awful lot like Miles Davis. In other words, when you listen to his early, you know, bluesy records, but then he went through a period where he played more beboppy, kind of. He was always Jimmy Smith, you know. But then he went into Root Down, where he started playing funk music, you know. So there you go. There's three generations right there, you know. And then he came back again when he was an older man and played another blues kind of thing with all the great blues artists. So he was able to adapt his talent to serve the need of the time, and that's what it's important to do if you're going to stay relevant as a musician.
When you played his supper club, what was it called?
The Jimmy Smith Supper Club.
And
he literally sat like probably 20 feet from the stage. He and Lola, he liked to drink mimosas, which is champagne and grapefruit juice, I think.
Something like that.
I mean, you know, and I was only 21, you know. And he sat right there, and I don't remember the name of the drummer. I was so freaked out that I was playing the gig. And I remember asking, I'll tell you, I've been blessed with honesty throughout my career. That's something that I hope that all musicians get and learn how to take honesty and apply it to hard work to better yourself as a musician. You see, it's not about our egos. It's about the journey to carry this thing called music, you know? So yes, it takes our ego to feel good about it, to excel, right? But we also have to learn humility along the way so that we stay teachable.
Well said.
Right? So I asked the drummer at the end of that set how I did, you know, because I thought I was a hot shot, 21 years old, you know. I thought the steak was sizzling on the plate. And he told me, he says, man, you got a lot of fire. He says, but you're very repetitious. That's the most honest thing that anyone could tell you, right? He was a drummer, right? So every time that I had a blessing like that, I consider those blessings. If somebody doesn't think you have talent, they're not going to waste their time to come, you know, to take the risk to be honest with you. So I took every one of those situations as them taking risks to help me become a better musician.
Did he mean that's repetitious with your choice of licks? Or
I would assume, because I, looking back, you know, I didn't have much depth. I just had a lot of fire, but I played a lot of blues scale, right? So my playing probably from one tune to the next was more about how fast I could play the blues scale not, you know, should I do this or should I do that? Should I play more bebop here? Should I develop more harmony? Should I, you know, because I just wasn't there yet. I was still growing as a musician. I teach today because I'm still in school. I'm still that kid that was playing at Jimmy Smith's Supper Club that's trying to learn how to play the right chords and not be repetitious.
I love hearing that. I agree. Like what Bob Dylan says, this is, if you're in the, on the music journey, it is a journey till you're done. And you should be always studying, always learning, always trying to improve. And like a year from now, I should, no matter how old I am, I should be better at this than I was a year before. And
that's
so
right.
Finding ways to, and have, just adjusting your relationship with it, with the tunes and the instrument, and always moving forward if you're a true student of this.
That's right. I want to stay a student, you know, because that means that I have hope to be better.
I agree. Did you meet any of the other greats?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had the chance to play with some of the greats. Like, for instance, I was on tour with Harvey Mason. I don't know if you know who Harvey Mason is.
Yeah.
Harvey Mason's the drummer that was known as one of the most recorded jazz drummers of all time. He's the guy that's on the track with Herbie Hancock playing Chameleon.
Oh, God.
The Headhunters. You know, that's Harvey Mason. He's also got a contemporary band, and he's still going, and he's older than I am, at least by 10-some years. He's still with that band called Foreplay. So it was touring with Harvey Mason that I got to meet tons of musicians, including Herbie Hancock and Vinnie Colaiuta and all the greats that play with in that genre, because they were friends. So I'd be out playing in L.A. with Harvey Mason, and, you know, someone like that just walked in, you know, just sitting down shooting the rap, you know.
Wow.
So, but then we got this gig to play at Java Jazz in Indonesia, which is a place that I've now played 15 years in a row. He hired Pat Martino to play with us. And Pat Martino's the legendary, he's deceased now, guitar player. And then after that tour, later on, about 6 months later, Pat called me and asked me to tour with him. And so then I got a chance to tour with Pat Martino for almost 3 years. And I met a whole nother bunch of great, great musicians, you know. And I've played with some of the best drummers in the world. I like to think that to be a great organ player, you have to not only know how to play notes and chords, you have to deal with rhythm. Because you are two-thirds of the rhythm section. So I don't know why they call it rhythm section if it doesn't have to do with groove. So I think groove is the most important part of the rhythm section. So I've been blessed to play with some very, very incredible drummers like Herlin Riley and Adam Nussbaum and, of course, Harvey Mason and youngsters like Jason Brown, you know. And I could just go on and on and on. And each one of those drummers have also taught me a lesson in music called how to deal with the rhythm. Some musicians, some drummers like to play behind the beat. Some like to play ahead of the beat. Some, when they do a fill, come down over here. Some, when they do a fill, come down over here. Well, if you're going to be cohesive with that rhythm section and sound tight, you got to be playing in the same spots that they're having you play in, that they like to play in. So to become a great musician, you have to be able to deal with that stuff, you know. So I've been blessed to be able to play with a lot of great musicians and drummers and guitar players that have helped me develop my harmony, develop my rhythm. So I'm like a chameleon, man, you know, when I play. Because usually when you're an organ player, what happens is the promoter flies you out by yourself because you're two-thirds of the rhythm section. And, you know, the budget in the kind of music I play is not the top of the budget, you know.
Yeah.
This is a small market. So, like, for instance, I got a gig coming up in April, you know, where they're flying me out to Oregon to play a gig. And I will meet the drummer and guitar player I've never played with for the first time right before the show and say, okay, guys, what do you want to play?
What do you generally, what's your fallback songs you usually lean on when you play with new players like that?
Well, you know, speaking about, you know, the new album that you mentioned, my Over and Over album that's just being released actually here in the next week. I have a reputation of some of the original songs that I've written. So I usually send ahead of time some tracks for them to at least listen to some of my recordings because I like to play original songs. You know, I'm at a point in my career when I'm delivering a show. I like to call it a show, a performance. I like to talk, you know, not just play. And I like to tell them the stories behind the songs, you know, that I've written. What, you know, I wrote a love ballad, you know, outside in the parking lot of a grocery store, you know, because that song came to me. And it was a love song as I was getting ready to go into the grocery store to buy chocolates and flowers. You know, so that's about the perfect time you might be thinking about writing a love song, you know. And then I wrote I'll Remember Jimmy when I found out he had passed, you know. And once I was in front of Sergio Mendez and he was performing for us, and I saw that big smile and his happiness and all that Latin music, and I wrote a song called Happy Sergio, you know. So songs come to you because if you're really writing songs that are influencing who you are, they're because moments like that, you know. So a lot of my songs are written in special moments, you know. So I like to kind of, when I'm performing, take the people down the journey of the moments that got, like for instance, I wrote a song that became a pretty big hit in Indonesia called Indonesian Nights. And a lot of people say, was that about, you know, some special lady or something? No, it was about, you know, traveling for 40 hours. And then now I'm stuck in a hotel and it's midnight in Indonesia, but it's noon in Columbus, Ohio, and I can't sleep.
Wow.
So I wrote Indonesian Nights because it was about insomnia, you know.
Would like to take a minute to thank the two sponsors of this week's podcast, Mosaic Chrysler Zumbrota and the B-Dale Club. Summer is here, almost here. Just got back from my family's cabin of a muddy, wet, but fun experience over in Wisconsin, and the dogs and I had a blast rocking and rolling from the cities to Wisconsin and back in the Black Jeep Cherokee X I got from Mosaic Chrysler. Their philosophy is simple, time-saving, hassle-free, fair price. Check out their inventory at ZumbrotaCDJR.com. Or take the beautiful drive down US 52 to 1900 Roscoe Avenue, Zumbrota, Minnesota, to visit them in person. Business hours are Monday through Friday, 8 to 6 p.m. and Saturday, 9 to 5 p.m. Closed on Sundays. Check out Mosaic Chrysler Zumbrota today and enjoy a safe spring summer season full of adventures and memories out in that open road in a new ride, man. Also, check out owner Monir's newest adventure in giving the best deals on vehicles, Mosaic Chevrolet. And the B-Dale Club, the BDC 2100, I like to call it, one of my favorite bars in the Roseville / St. Paul, Minnesota area. The B-Dale Club, located in the corner counter of B and Dale's, motto is a place for family, a place for friends, a place for fun, and that is a stone cold truth. Looking forward to this Thursday, tomorrow actually, to rocking the BDC with Ryan Young on fiddle, Brian Johnson on bass, and me playing all the other goofy instruments. Should be a good time. Natalie, Shelley, Dustin, the entire bar staff are all state-of-the-art cocktail wizards. As of late, my libation of choice is a classic screw-up cocktail. And there to quote 60-time world champion Ric Flair, tasted little devils. The new Pity Q Barbecue is an excellent addition to the BDC experience, and the food is award-winning. Go talk to Troy down there. Live music, pool table, pull tabs, Tuesday Night Chess Society, bingo, meat raffle, bocce ball Thursdays, and much, much more. B-Dale's literally got it all. Stop by for a cold one today. Some of the songs I really liked off your new record. How about the song? So you're talking about notes. Ready, Set, Go. You have a ferocious solo in that. And that's what I was going to ask you today about in my lesson. How the hell you go up and down that fast in that solo at, no pun intended, at 420. That's in a part of the song. What? Hold on. I got something. Something's dropped. I wonder what's going on. What was the story behind that song?
Well, my favorite one of my favorite young players that has deceased. His name was Joey DeFrancesco. And we were both working a NAMM show one time. We both were endorsing the Hammond Suzuki products. And, you know, we were talking about our favorite Jimmy Smith albums. And his favorite Jimmy Smith album was The Boss. And The Boss is Jimmy Smith going nuts on a D minor blues. So Ready, Set, Go is in homage to Jimmy Smith tearing it up on a song called The Boss. And some of the techniques that Jimmy Smith was using in The Boss, I was trying to emulate my way, of course, on Ready, Set, Go. So that's what stimulated that one.
That's some ferocious playing on that one.
But because it takes off the way it does, you know, the title became Ready, Set, Go. I didn't think, well, let me write a song called Ready, Set, Go, you know. But it came with that, you know. You know, it was cooking, you know, so it came off like Ready, Set, Go, right?
That's awesome. How about the first track, Da Daddy?
Okay, Da Daddy. Okay, this is funny. I'm glad you're asking me these things. You did your homework well, Mark. Stanley Turrentine wrote a song called Sugar. It was one of his big hits. And contrafacting is, you know, listen, man, you can't write a whole set of chord changes today that haven't been written or played by somebody somewhere along the history of music. So as original as you'd like to think we are, a 2-5-1 has been around a long, long, long time, you know? So no 2-5-1s are going to impress anybody, you know? But it's the order in which you put these things. So a lot of times tunes are written as what they call contrafact. In other words, if I said, I got rhythm, I got music, right? Well, that's where Olio came from. It's actually known when you play jazz heads, rhythm changes. Let's play rhythm changes. So in other words, you're playing the chord changes to I Got Rhythm with a new melody written on it. Well, Bobby Pierce, remember I told you that great guy that's still alive on the West Coast who's an organ player? He had showed me a long time ago some alternate changes to the song from Stanley Turrentine called Sugar. So what Da Daddy is, I was thinking I was going to call it Sugar Daddy because of the sugar, you know. Then I thought with my age and everything, maybe I don't want to be associated as Sugar Daddy. So Da Daddy became the title, right? But the A section, you know, some songs have an A section and then they have a bridge and then they have an A, the return. The A section is a pretty reharmonized contrafact of sugar with alternate changes. So sugar goes. And mine goes. Alternate. Now you can't really hear sugar in that, but believe it or not, the basis of those chord changes are very much like an alternate version of sugar.
So cool.
But that's why it's Da Daddy and not Sugar Daddy.
I love it.
I'm still young.
How about the title track Over and Over?
So Over and Over, man, you want to hear the real story behind this one. This is funnier than heck. So about 2 years ago, I had received a text from someone, and I noticed it was a California area code. And I wasn't up to it yet. I didn't realize this was a scamming technique. But it was this text message that said, I just wanted you to know I'm not going to be able to make my yoga appointment this afternoon. So I try to be a gentleman, you know. So I replied back to this person and I said, I just want you to know that, you know, I'm not your yoga instructor. You know, just so you know that you didn't reach your yoga, I think you dialed the wrong number. And this opened up this person to start a dialogue with me. Next thing you know, she's sending me pictures. You know, I don't know that the pictures were even of the person I was communicating with, right? And then quickly they want you to move over to a free application because they're having to pay for those text messages. So they want to get you on an app because they're actually contacting you from some other place in Asia. Could be China, could be anywhere, right? So the short story was her aunt was really big in investments and she lived in Singapore and she had some insider trading information for Bitcoin stuff, cyber money. And she was trying to get me set up to make a transaction, you know, for this Bitcoin company. But I started to catch on to the fact that this was most likely somebody scamming me. But the pictures she was sending, she was gorgeous. So over and over again was written, because what I did to impress her was I did an electronic version of this because it kind of sounds like a sexy song, right? It's got... right? So I recorded it and I put it up on YouTube. It was an electronic version. So if you go up on YouTube and you type in over and over, you'll find that. It's up there because I used DistroKid to release a self-release, but it's an electronic version, you know, to impress her, you know. And she said to me, wow, you know, I'd never had anybody try to do that, you know. So over and over ended up being titled that because she was trying over and over and over to get me to buy Bitcoin, you know. But she failed because when it came down to the day, I used the real calling card. When it came down to the day to make the transaction, I told her I was a poor musician. And I didn't have any money. We couldn't do it right now anyhow. I never heard from her again. So how do you get rid of a scammer? Tell them you're a poor musician. They know you ain't got any money.
You've been reading my mail, Tony. Oh, my God.
I had
hilarious.
Fun with it. I played with it for a while. You know, I got a kick, you know. If it really was this person, you know, daunting over me, it was flattering for a minute. You never know who it really was, though, you know.
No kidding. So when you record a record, are you recording the entire thing live in the studio, or do you kind of piece it together? And then I have a question about, like, when you compose riffs, like you compose your head verse for like Ready, Set, Go or Over and Over, how do you go about doing that?
Those things just come to you, right? Like, I think the nicest composition on that record is Sailboat.
Yeah.
And My Little Rosie Girl, which is about a little cat that we had that I really loved, and she died. Her name was Rosie.
Oh, boy.
So Rosie Girl is all about this little pretty little cat, and Sailboat, I just titled it Sailboat. It sounds like a good title for that tune, but I thought that the harmony was real nice on that, you know. But when I write songs, they just come. And I go through dry spells. I went through years where I wasn't writing anything. Then all of a sudden I wrote this whole album. And, you know, other than Over and Over, which was written a couple of years ago for the scammer, the rest of the tunes were written all like 2 weeks before I set the recording date. And I said, you know, we got to have original tunes. You know, and I had a burst of creative flow, you know, that I wrote all these tunes, you know, and here they are, you know, and I think some of them are pretty nice, you know, and some of them are contrafacty, like Uprooted, you know, it's not exactly the same form as Root Down, now get it, Uprooted, but it's similar. And the team for this record was that I wanted to use this young, up-and-coming, exciting, open-the-playground-and-run guitar player with a drummer that challenges me rhythmically to put those two together with me. And yes, did we record it spontaneously? Of course. That's the only way you can play jazz. You know, and so there's a few takes of each one of those tunes, you know, obviously. And that's a bad thing. If you get a couple good takes, you don't know which one to keep. That's a hard problem to have, you know. So, but you usually know when you record it which one felt right, you know.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You probably can't believe that was recorded right here in my house. It was not
really
recorded in the studio. I've been mastering and mixing my own records. What I do is, today I put the organ straight through a simulator that sounds like a Leslie speaker. So I got no drum bleed on the organ. You know what I mean? So I'm not micing a Leslie. I'm using, listen to the simulator. That's not a Leslie. That's a simulator.
Wow.
So the drummer can play as loud as he wants, you know, it's not going to get in there. And then what I did with the drummer is I put him just on the other side of this room. I got a door open so I could see him, because you got to see who you're playing with, right? And he was in like the dining room area with no dining room table, and it was mic'd perfectly. You know, that room sounds great for drums. And the guitar amp, I shoved it down in the room next door and put it in another room all by itself, so that the instruments were all isolated. That's why it sounds so clean.
Wow.
It's like and that was recorded right here in my house with good preamps and good mics, but the organ was just two channels, a simulator.
So how do you choose? So one thing I was going to ask you about, if people are starting in the organ, especially when you're recording live right there, how do you choose your draw bar settings?
Yeah, well, man, my draw bar settings are pretty tried and true to what I heard on those records.
I've been looking at yours, and you generally have, even at our lesson last time, you had the Jimmy Smith draw bar setup, right? The first three down.
About every organ player you hear uses the Jimmy Smith sound. And then I have a set, so if I take the percussion off of it, then I get that groove ohms.
With that little whistle on the top.
That little whistle.
God, I love that.
That's the groove, and it's a lot on that record. You know, Giants.
I noticed that. How where do you set that whistle, the last draw bar?
So the way the organ is made, the last draw bar, there's 9 draw bars per set where sounds are made from, right? So you get the one set that made the B3 what it was, because before the B3 was an instrument called the B2. And the difference between the B2 and the B3 is they added that percussion sound. That percussion, right? So you take that and you add it to the sound of the draw bars. Then you get the B3 sound. So, you know, that sound is pretty typical. Sometimes some people add the fourth draw bar to it. What's his name? Charles Erlin.
Yeah.
So Charles had 4 draw bars. I like 3 because that's what Jimmy used. So I used the first 3 and the last, number 9. But the way they designed the B3 is they stole the power from the 9th draw bar, so when the percussion's on, it cancels that groove home sound.
Yeah.
I just call it group home sound.
It takes out that whistle sound.
It takes the whistle out. And then so when you turn the percussion off, you hear the whistle.
Where do you have your whistle set? Just curious.
Just the first three and the last one.
All the way cranked?
That's it.
You have it.
888-0000008.
Wow. And then just go back and forth. I love that.
Yeah, just turning the percussion on.
Wow.
And then on the second set of draw bars, I'll do combinations of all draw bars if I want to get that big blast everything off sound. Or I'll thin it out and put a little bit. Just differences. So there's all kinds of little draw bar secrets, but you know, if you listen to over and over, I'd say probably 80% of it, it's just the first three draw bars with percussion, because that's the sound all the jazz people associate with the organ. Sometimes when you get all those other sounds, they start calling it roller skating, you know, so you got to be careful that it doesn't come off a little camp, you know.
Do you add chorus to it too?
Mm-hmm.
Just add all the bells and whistles.
Yeah, so like if you listen to it dry, you know, I add a little chorus. But on over and over, I used it dry because I didn't want that chorus.
Do you add any overdrive?
You know, the organ overdrives itself. It's got two preamp, you know.
Yeah.
So when you're cranking it, it will. But I don't like to overdrive it. I like my recordings to be as clean as possible, you know. Yeah.
Well, because of you, I have financed something. I bought the new, and we'll talk about this in our next lesson, but I bought the new Hammond M Solo 1. So it's that little one you can take from gig to gig, and it's mostly for like soloing what I do. And so it's people seem to love it.
Is it four octaves, the keyboard?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay, so they say took off one octave. I'm going to have to talk to Scott May. You know, I endorse Hammond Suzuki these days.
Wow. So, I mean, this thing is it's brand new. It's got some extra sounds, but it's supposed to be just exactly like a Hammond organ. Like, okay. It is a Hammond. I mean, it's a beautiful instrument. I'll show you next time. I got this burgundy color one. It is beautiful. I'm so proud of it.
Not about it. Okay. It has electric piano and grand piano and all that, too?
It has. No, it's got some different stuff. It's mostly for the B3, and then it's got a VX.
It's mostly organ.
Ace. Yeah. It's got some other stuff. I haven't monkeyed with it because I'm so obsessed with the B3 sound.
Yeah.
You know? Gotcha. So before we get done here real quick, I know you got to go in about 5 minutes. Can you tell us about your teaching? If people want to get a lesson from you, I mean, you're such an enthusiastic person. If people look at your YouTube page, you're just rocking and rolling. Your passion for music and passion for teaching is literally contagious. So if someone wants to have a lesson with you or meet up with you, how would they go about doing that?
Well, my website is easy to remember. I play the Hammond B3, right? And my last name is Monaco, like the country. So if you just go to b3monaco.com, that's my website, and you can find my lessons page. It's right at the top that you can click there. And I have lesson deals, introductory lesson deals. I love to teach because when I was 16, my father I convinced him that I really needed to play the organ. And so he finally bought me my first B3. We went to the music store. There was like 20 of them on one wall. And they were already 20-some years old because we're talking about 1976, you know. So this organ that I picked out was a 1955. So it was already 21 years old when I bought it, you know. And I love this one. But there was a local guy who was giving lessons. And, you know, to learn the organ, you got to learn these draw bars and then what to do. I had a great teacher. His name was Jim Russell. God rest his soul. He was so good. I wanted to be just like Jim, just like I wanted to be like Jimmy Smith. I wanted to be a good teacher, you know? So I got the blessing in 2006 when the crash, this was preceding the crash, but, you know, I used to run a big construction company. I had, you know, in 2006, we had to basically shut down because the construction industry shut down due to the fact there was all these irresponsible loans. That's what caused the crash. So all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I'm on the, you know, because to make enough money as a musician is hard, man. And today it's almost impossible. Most working musicians, unless they're old stars that still have a career going, they got a day gig. And that's normal. So it's not a bad thing. It's just normal. Well, I wanted to continue to be a full-time musician at that point in time because the industry, the construction industry, had kicked me out. So I think God was telling me, okay, it's time to fly, you know, as a musician. So I started some online lessons with a couple of people from far away. One guy in Wisconsin, one guy in Brazil. And I developed a system to be able to do it, and I got good at it, you know, because I do it every day now. So I carry about 20 to 25 lessons a week. I have a student roster of about 50 or so. You know, some take every week, some take every other week, some take once a month, you know. So I work flexible with the person I'm teaching, you know. And I carry a lot of students, so I always have enough of a schedule. So just go to b3monaco.com. I got a nice little take 1 hour lesson. You did that. And I videotaped it. You get all of the videotape. And it's videotape. You know, video file.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's unbelievable.
Just $40 for your trial lesson, you know.
Yeah.
So go to b3monaco.com. Check out my new record Over and Over if you want an autographed copy. I also have, I don't know if you saw this, Mark, but I'll tell you what I would like to do to gift you since you were so kind to me today. I'm going to send you a link to download your own very own play-along. So it's got the MP3 high-res version, but then it's got sets with no bass, no drums, no guitar, no top of the organ, no organ at all. So you can actually play along to Over and Over.
Really?
I'm going to send that to you right now as soon as we're done, okay?
All right. Sounds good, my friend. Thank you so much, Tony Monaco, for being on the show. We ran it right to the very end here. Do you have like 30 seconds, one little outro, little piano part you can play for us or organ part?
Oh, yeah.
So, and we'll talk soon, Tony. Thanks so much for being on the show, my friend.
How about a little one for Pat?
Love it.
Mm-hmm. Huh? God bless you, Mark. We'll see you soon. Thanks. And get a hold of me, okay?
I sure will. Thanks, Tony. This has been the Minnesota Music Shakedown. If you'd like to toss a buck or two into the podcast tip jar, please go to patreon.com/MarkSterryMusic. If you like what I do, check out my website, MarkSterryMusic.com. For artist or song submissions, please email me at MarkSterryMusic@gmail.com or message me on social media. Thanks for tuning in. Till next time.
Thank you.